Alrighty, boys, I made it. We made it. We're all gonna make it. Frankly, we are. We're making it. What are we making? Things. We're just making things. RJJ, Scotch Cuban, Andrew Quinn, and Mr. Max. Welcome, fans. Oh, Archangelus. Welcome, fine gentlemen. I praise God for you all. Andrew, six people maximum, or I'm dialing Fauci. Well, you can call that Fed. Don't call that Fed. You're wasting your time. Mr. Max, can't stay, but thank you for an enlightened stream. God bless you, sir. Archangelus, a one-way ticket to Bastville, please. Coming right up. W. Laser, welcome. Fine, sir. A good day to you. Kodiak Joe, good afternoon. Fine, sir. Well, gentlemen, it's been quite a weekend. I felt something coming on the whole of last week, but I braved through it, but it got me down hard on the weekend. I was koofing a lot of things. I do not believe in getting tested. Screw that. So it was just a koof, a mild koof. My wife made me many herbal elixirs and things of which to embalm my throat. It was therapeutic. I had baths with Epsom salts and herbs, herbal spices. And here I am. Here I am. No one can take me down. Not even feds can't take me down. Drongo, good evening, fine sir. Well, I hope you all had a wonderful weekend, gents. I did. Obviously, just laying low and enjoying myself, reading a few things, and was on Seanathan Corey's live stream last night. Was really enjoyable. It's my first long form interview. We went like 2 hours. I was like, no ways. Had to prepare my bladder for that one. it was great. We just chatted a lot about all the things we like to chat about. So it was really fun. And a lot of you guys on Twitter were getting unruly. Old 10 Keys found himself a copy of the history of the Third Reich, and asked if anyone knew anything about it. And I said, well, I have a copy. Let's read it together. And then Scotch Cuban got out of hand and wanted to start talking about coffee table books of certain Austrian artists. And so now all of a sudden we have the clamor for a book club. Look at us. Look at us. Things escalated really quickly. So we will do the book club. Perhaps we'll have to come up with many pseudonyms for the coffee table book so as not to get banned. Anyway, today we will finish the third chapter of de Tocqueville, who was the French. No, he was not the French artist. He was just a little aristocratic dandy boy who had some good takes and was probably an altogether good dude. We don't really know. Archangelus, I am a survivor, stunning and brave. Kodiak, I had a very productive weekend, worked the sickness right out of my body. See, now that's impressive when a man can just sweat it out through the strictures of manual labor. I imagine you shirtless in the Pacific mist, probably like 40 degrees, splitting cordwood with a huge axe while you sweat. Get it all out. Drongo, book clubs are great. I've been enjoying reading along to Tocqueville a bit. Well, thank you, fine sir. It's been enjoyable myself. I too need the discipline and help of our friends to keep make sure I'm reading books and not timelines, if you know what I'm saying. The ADIQ desire is to read small little tweets. It's like, no, we need to also delve into some longer form things. Good. Kodiak Joe, you'll see that I'm quite prescient as to what people do. I even once correctly attributed that Mr. Max lived in a swamp, a northern French Canadian bayou, and I was somehow kind of correct. I'm very, very impressed with myself. Here we go. De Tocqueville. Reasons for certain peculiar features of the laws and customs of the Anglo-Americans. Some relics of aristocratic institutions amid the most complete democracy. Why? The need to distinguish carefully between that which is Puritan in origin and that which is English. The reader must not draw unduly general or absolute conclusions from what has just been said. The social condition, religion, and mores of the first immigrants no doubt exerted an immense influence on the destiny of their adopted land. Nevertheless, it was not within their power to found a society whose point of departure lay exclusively within themselves. No one can free himself entirely from the past. Intentionally or not, they combined ideas and customs of their own with others that they took from their education and from the national traditions of their homeland. If we wish to make an informed judgment about the Anglo-Americans as they are today, we must therefore take care to distinguish between that which is Puritan in origin and that which is English. In the United States, one encounters laws and customs that contrast with everything around them. These laws appear to have been drafted in a spirit contrary to the dominant spirit of American legislation. These mores seem to conflict with the state of society in general. If the English colonies had been founded in a century of darkness, or if their origins were already lost in the night of time, the problem would be insoluble. I will cite but a single example to illustrate what I mean. Only two means of action are provided for under American civil and criminal law: imprisonment and bail. In any legal proceeding, the first step is to obtain bail from the defendant, or if he declines, to incarcerate him. Only afterward is the validity of the title or the gravity of the charge discussed. Such legislation is obviously directed against the poor and favors only the rich. The poor man cannot always make bail, even in a civil case, and if he is compelled to await justice in prison, enforced idleness will soon reduce him to misery. By contrast, the rich man can always avoid imprisonment in a civil case. Worse yet, if he has committed a crime, he can easily avoid punishment by vanishing after making bail. Thus, all the penalties of the law are for him reduced to fines. What legislation could be more aristocratic than this? He has a footnote. There are no doubt some crimes for which bail is not allowed, but their number is quite small. In America, however, it is the poor who make the law, and usually they reserve society's greatest benefits for themselves. The explanation of this paradox must be sought in England. The laws I speak of are English. The Americans have not changed them, even though they run counter to the general tenor of American legislation and to the preponderance of American ideas. Apart from customs, the thing that a nation is least likely to change is its civil legislation. The only people truly conversant with the civil code are specialists in the law. That is, those who have a direct interest in maintaining it as is, good or bad, for the simple reason that they are familiar with it. Most people have only a vague knowledge of the law. They perceive its effects only in particular cases. They have difficulty in discerning its general implications and obey it without thinking. I have mentioned one example, but I might have called attention to any number of others. American society, if I may put it this way, is like a painting that is democratic on the surface, but from time to time allows the old aristocratic colors to peep through. You know, and this is just talking again about the institutional power of wealth. You know, gold, crown, and sword. You know, the gold controls very, very many times the sword. You know, the sword is the executive branch, the courts, the police, the military, those that enforce the law, and the crown, obviously, the legislatives. You know, the ones who create the law, who create what is legal and illegal. You know, what is righteous, what is wicked, and gold influences all of it. You know, it's very, very interesting, the power of the aristocratic institution of wealth. It's very much that way as well. You know, any fine, you know, you think of speeding tickets, you think of, you know, whatever law has a fine as its punishment. It really is. It's only a law for the poor. It's very, very erudite. James, welcome, fine sir. Got you in the background while I write landing page copy. Well, God bless you, my fine sir. I will have to, at this point, say that that copy will be the best copy in the world because it's Dotoku kind of in there. Let us alone. Welcome, fine sir, and salute, as it were. You are welcomed. Chapter 3, Social State of the Anglo-Americans. The social state is ordinarily the result of a fact, sometimes of laws, usually of these two causes taken together. Once it exists, however, it can itself be considered the primary cause of most of the laws, customs, and ideas that govern the conduct of nations. What it does not produce, it modifies. If one would know a people's legislation and mores, one must therefore begin by studying its social state. What is most striking about the social state of the Anglo-Americans is that it is essentially democratic. Many important remarks could be made about the social state of the Anglo-Americans, but one stands out above all the rest. The social state of the Americans is eminently democratic. It has had this character since the birth of its colonies. It has it even more today. I said in the previous chapter that a very high degree of equality prevailed among the immigrants who settled on the coast of New England. The very seed of aristocracy was never sown in this part of the Union. Only intellectual influences could be established there. People became accustomed to venerating certain names as emblems of enlightenment and virtue. The voices of a few citizens obtained a kind of power over them that might reasonably have been called aristocratic had it been possible always to pass it on from father to son. Such was the case east of the Hudson. Southwest of that river and all the way to Florida, things were different. Great English landowners settled in most of the states southwest of the Hudson. Aristocratic principles were imported along with English laws of inheritance. Earlier, I stated the reasons why it proved impossible to establish a powerful aristocracy in America. Although these reasons also obtained southwest of the Hudson, their influence there was less potent than it was east of that river. In the south, a single man could, with the help of slaves, cultivate a vast expanse of land. Hence, in this part of the continent, it was possible to find wealthy landowners. But their influence was not precisely aristocratic, as that term is understood in Europe, because they possessed no privileges, and because the use of slaves to cultivate the land left them without tenants, and consequently, without patronage. Still, the great landowners south of the Hudson constituted a superior class, with ideas and tastes of its own, and generally concentrating political activity within its own ranks. It was sort of aristocracy that differed little from the mass of the population, whose passions and interests it readily embraced, arousing neither love nor hatred. In short, it was feeble and not particularly robust. In the South, it was this class that took command of the insurrection. To it, the American Revolution is indebted for its greatest men. In that time, the whole of society was shaken. The people in whose name one had fought became a force to be reckoned with, and no conceived the desire to act on their own. Let me read that again. In that time, the whole of society was shaken. The people in whose name one had fought became a force to be reckoned with, and conceived the desire to act on their own. Democratic instincts were awkward. Smashing the yoke of the metropolis had fostered a taste for independence of every kind. Little by little, the influence of individuals ceased to make itself felt. Custom and law began to march in step toward a common goal. But it was the law of inheritance that drove equality to take the last step. I am astonished that ancient and modern writers on public matters have not ascribed greater influence over human affairs to the laws governing inheritance. By inheritance laws, I mean all laws whose principal purpose is to regulate the disposition of property after the death of its owner. Such laws belong, of course, to the civil order, but they should be placed first among political institutions because of their incredible influence on a people's social state, of which the political laws are merely the expression. Furthermore, inheritance laws act on society in a sure and uniform way. In a sense, they lay hold of each generation before it is born. Through them, man is armed with an almost divine power over the future of his fellow men. Once the legislator has regulated inheritance among citizens, he can rest for centuries. Once his work has been set in motion, he can remove his hands from his creation. The machine acts under its own power and seems almost to steer itself toward a goal designated in advance. If constructed in a certain way, it collects, concentrates, and aggregates property, and before long,
power as well around a single head. It causes aristocracy to spring, as it were, from the soil. If guided by other principles and launched on a different path, its effect is still more rapid. It divides, partitions, and disseminates wealth and power. In that case, the rapidity of its progress is sometimes frightening. Abandoning hope of halting its progress, people at least try to place difficulties and obstacles in its path. They would counteract its effects by contrary efforts, but in vain. The machinery of the law crushes or shatters anything in its way. It rises up from the earth only to hammer down again and again until nothing remains but a shifting, impalpable dust on which democracy rests. When the law of inheritance permits, and a fortiori when it orders, a father's property to be divided equally among his children, its effects are of two kinds. It is important to distinguish carefully between them, even though both tend toward the same end. By virtue of the law of inheritance, the death of any owner of property entails a revolution in ownership. Not only do goods change masters, they also change nature, so to speak. They are broken up into ever smaller portions. This is the direct and, as it were, material effect of the law. In countries whose laws provide for equal partition, property and especially landed wealth necessarily has a permanent tendency to shrink. If the law were left to its own devices, however, the effects of such legislation would become apparent only over the long run. For to the extent that families consist of no more than two children, and the family average in a country populated like France is said to be just three, the children, sharing the wealth of their father and mother, will not be poorer than each parent individually. But the law of equal partition does not exert its influence solely on the fate of property. It also works upon the very soul of the owner, whose passions are enlisted in its behalf. It is the indirect effects of the law that rapidly destroy great fortunes, and especially great estates. Among peoples whose law of inheritance is based upon primogeniture, landed estates ordinarily pass undivided from generation to generation. As a result, the family spirit, in a sense, becomes materialized in the earth. The family represents the land represents the family. The land perpetuates the family's name, its origins, its glory, its power, and its virtues. It is an imperishable witness to the past and a precious guarantee of continued existence. When the law of inheritance requires equal partition, it destroys the intimate bond that once existed between family spirit and preservation of the land. The land ceases to represent the family because within the space of a generation or two, it cannot avoid being divided and must therefore shrink until ultimately it disappears entirely. The sons of a great landowner, if few in number or favored by fortune, may nurse hopes of rivaling the wealth of the author of their days, but not of owning the same property. The composition of their fortunes must necessarily be different from his. Now, the moment you divide landowners of any great interest they may have in preserving the land, whether of sentiment, memories, pride, or ambition, you may rest assured that sooner or later they will sell. They have a great pecuniary interest in doing so, since movable capital yields more interest than other forms of capital and lends itself more readily to gratifying the passions of the moment. Once divided, great landed estates can never be put back together, for the smallholder derives proportionally greater income from his field than the great landowner does from his. The former will therefore demand a far higher price for his land than did the latter. Thus, the economic calculations that led the rich man to sell his vast properties will, for even stronger reasons, prevent him from buying small holdings in order to reconstitute a large one. What is called family spirit is often based on an egotistical illusion. A person may seek to perpetuate and, as it were, immortalize himself in his posterity. When family spirit attains its limits, individual selfishness reasserts its penchants. Because the family is now present in mind only as a vague, indefinite, uncertain thing, the individual focuses his attention on present comforts. He thinks only of establishing the next generation and nothing more. Hence, he does not seek to perpetuate his family, or at any rate seeks to perpetuate it by means other than landed property. Thus, the law of inheritance not only makes it difficult for families to keep their estates intact, it deprives them of the desire even to attempt to do so, and leads them in a way to cooperate with the law in their own ruin. The law of equal partition proceeds along two paths. By acting on things, it acts on men, and by acting on men, it strikes at things. In these two ways, it succeeds in attacking landed property at its root, soon causing families and fortunes to disappear. And he has some footnotes. I do not mean that the smallholder is a better farmer, but he farms with greater ardor and care, and makes up with toil for what he lacks in skill. Because land is the most substantial form of property, one occasionally encounters wealthy men who are prepared to make great sacrifices in order to acquire it, and who will readily sacrifice a considerable portion of their income to pay for its upkeep. But they are accidents. The love of real estate is common nowadays only among the poor. The smallholder, who is less enlightened, less imaginative, and less passionate than the great landowner, is generally preoccupied solely by the dim, little by little, with the means to do so. Thus, along with the tendency that impels men to divide the land, there exists another, which leads them to aggregate it. This tendency, which suffices to prevent the division of property ad infinitum, is not powerful enough to create great landed fortunes, much less to confine such fortunes within some families. Surely it is not for us, Frenchmen of the 19th century and daily witnesses to the political and social changes to which the law of inheritance has given rise, to cast doubt on its power. Every day we watch, as again and again, it cuts swathes across our land, knocking down the walls of our homes and destroying the enclosures around our fields. But if the law of inheritance has already done a great deal among us, much remains to be achieved. Here, memories, opinions, and habits constitute powerful obstacles in its path. In the United States, its work of destruction is almost complete. There, one can study its chief results. English laws governing the transmission of property were abolished in nearly all the states at the time of the Revolution. The law of entail was amended so as to place only an imperceptible restriction on the free circulation of property. The first generation passed away. The division of the land began. The pace of change increased as time went by. Today, barely 60 years later, the face of society is already unrecognizable. The families of the great landowners have nearly all been absorbed into the common mass. In the state of New York, where there were many such families, just two have managed to remain afloat above the chasm that awaits. The sons of once opulent citizens are today merchants, lawyers, and doctors. Most have fallen into the uttermost depths of obscurity. The last vestiges of hereditary rank and distinction have been destroyed. Everywhere the law of inheritance has fixed its level. Note not that there are no wealthy people in the United States, just as there are everywhere. Indeed, I know of no other country where the love of money occupies as great a place in the hearts of men, or where people are more deeply contemptuous of the theory of permanent equality of wealth. But wealth circulates there with incredible rapidity, and experience teaches that it is rare for two successive generations to garner its favors. This picture, which to some may seem overdrawn, still gives only an incomplete idea of what is happening in the new states of the West and Southwest. At the end of the last century, bold adventurers began to make their way into the valleys of the Mississippi. This was almost a new discovery of America. Before long, the majority of new immigrants were headed for that region. Hitherto unknown societies sprang up in the wilderness overnight. States that had been nameless only a few years before took their place in the American Union. In the West, it was possible to observe democracy pushed to its ultimate limit. In these states, in a sense improvised by fortune, people lived on land to which they had come only a short while before. They barely knew one another, and none knew the history of his nearest neighbor. In this part of the American continent, the population therefore escaped the influence not only of great names and great wealth, but also of that natural aristocracy which derives from enlightenment and virtue. Here, no one exercised the respectable power that men grant to the memory of a life wholly devoted to doing good in the public eye. The new states of the West were already inhabited, but no society yet existed there. In America, however, it is not only fortunes that are equal. Equality extends to some degree to intelligence itself. I do not think that there is any other country in the world where, as a proportion of the population, the ignorant are so few and the learned still fewer. Primary education is within the reach of everyone. Higher education is within the reach of virtually no one. This is not hard to understand. In a sense, it is the necessary result of what I have set forth above. Almost all Americans are comfortably well off. Hence, they can easily acquire the rudiments of human knowledge. In America, few people are wealthy. Almost all Americans, therefore, need to practice a profession. Now, every profession requires a period of apprenticeship. Americans can therefore afford to devote only the first few years of life to the general cultivation of the intelligence. At 15, they embark on a career. Thus, their education usually ends at the time of life when ours begins. If it continues beyond that period, its aim becomes exclusively specialized and lucrative. One studies a science as one takes up a craft, and one takes from it only those applications whose present utility is recognized. In America, most of the rich started out poor. Almost all men of leisure were occupied in youth. Hence, in the time of life when a person might have a taste for study, he has no time for it. And when he has acquired time to devote to it, he no longer has the taste. Hence, there is no class in America in which the penchant for intellectual pleasures is passed on along with hereditary wealth and leisure, and which holds work of the intelligence in high esteem. Thus, the will to devote oneself to such works is lacking, and so is the ability. A certain middling level of human understanding has been established in America. Minds of every sort have approached this standard, some by raising themselves up, others by lowering themselves. One therefore finds a vast multitude of individuals who share virtually the same number of notions in matters of religion, history, science, political economy, law, and government. Intellectual inequality comes directly from God, and man can do nothing to prevent it. Yet even if intelligence remains, as God willed, unequally distributed, the resources at its disposal are, as we have just seen, equal. Today, therefore, the aristocratic element in America, weak from the outset, has been, if not destroyed, then at least weakened to the point where it is difficult to ascribe to it any influence whatsoever in the course of affairs. By contrast, time, events, and laws have made the democratic element not only preponderant, but in a manner of speaking, unrivaled. No familial or corporate influence can be discerned. Indeed, it is often impossible to detect any individual influence that is in any way durable. America's social state, therefore, exhibits the most curious phenomenon. Men there can be seen to be more equal in fortune and intelligence, more equally strong, in other words, than they are in any other country or were at any other time in recorded history. So it's really interesting, a few things there that he really hits on. Aristocracy, inheritance, equality. It's a very interesting concept to really think about France, you know, where he was saying before the revolution in France, the laws of inheritance was primogeniture. So the oldest son took on the whole estate. And privilege, aristocratic privilege, it was really great what he said there of how power is only aristocratic if you can hand that power down, if you can hand that influence down to the next generation, then it's aristocratic. Whereas in America, the laws were, you know, you divide the estate up between all the children. And so there's the dividing of wealth, the dividing of estate, the dividing of power. And so it created an incredible rising or raising of the standard, the tide of the middle class. You know, that's the American dream, is that poor people are raised. And that's where they say as well, why there's no elite, why there's no aristocracy in America, is because after one or two generations, there's a great middling. Now that middling is still above the great masses of the rest of the world, Europe included. But it's all very interesting, you know, how we are now coming back to these aristocratic principles, the desire for powerful men who are connected to their place and their people to have a long view of loving their place, loving their people, using their power and wealth and influence for the good of their people in place. But that only happens when that wealth is rooted. And so it's really interesting what he says here, how dividing wealth, dividing inheritance causes a liquidity of place, a liquidity of rootedness, you know. It's very interesting. It's all very interesting. Kodiak, death tax is the most despicable of all taxes. Yeah, death tax, land tax, currency printing, it's all very despicable. Scotch Cuban, why can't we write this way today? Well, sir, it is because we are, I was going to say, a very disparaging thing, but no, it's not. It's, we have been dumbed down, and it is upon us to make our children a little bit cleverer than we are. I like what he says there as well about it is an aristocratic society that allows for young men to really pursue intellectual pursuits, whereas the American boy starts working at 15 and pursues learning only to that which is utilitarian toward his trade. And that is, again, what made America such an amazing, you know, the rugged individualist who can do everything. You know, practically, praxeologically, the American man is the most competent in history, the most competent set of men. It's really interesting to think, on one hand, the great philosophers and intellectuals and theologians, a lot of times are divorced or disconnected from the working man and the practical and the praxeological. And that's often the downfall of the midwit, you know, of the person who is so overeducated and thinks very highly of their intelligence, thinks very highly of their learning, yet practically are absolute trifling midwits who are absolutely outperformed by Grugbrain ADIQ men who started working at 15 with their hands on and are now very competent and wealthy, proficient men at their trades, at their thing in life. They are geniuses. You know, at their thing in life, they can make machines hum. They can make wood into houses. They can make ground into food. Like the magic of the ADIQ man who is proficient in his trade, in his skill, far outshines the midwit who thinks he's a big brain because of his learning. You must call me doctor. Doctor of what? Of philosophy. It's like, screw you. It's hilarious. No offense to the actual big brain doctors of philosophy who solve important life questions. God bless you. Kodiak Joe, I've seen many great 20K plus acre farms, ranches get split up by the children of the farmer, or the farmer is forced to sell to do rising property taxes. Yeah, it's a huge sadness with death taxes today. You know, even if you think small inheritances, you know, if you wanted to gift your house to one of your children, there's going to be death taxes, and often they have to sell the house to pay the taxes if they are not wealthy enough to absorb that. It is criminal. And then it's interesting what de Tocqueville said about the splitting up of huge acreages, you know. So on one hand, huge estates ground a family. You know, it's that thing that Wendell Berry says, that after, once a property goes multi-generational, the property owns the family, you know. And great estates are synonymous with great family names. It's also interesting what he says about how when you divide up into smaller lots, the smaller lot steward is more industrious. You know, he's more profitable with his small lot than can be the great estate. You know, because the great estate, it takes a lot of scale to be able to make it productive. So it's an interesting middle ground there, you know, of you kind of see the merits in both. And there's an interesting middle ground of, you know, you want the productivity of small homestead farmers or small property development caretaker, you know, the man who can develop and caretake his little property, his little one coin talent with extreme industry and proficiency and mastery. But on the other hand, the great value of having huge estates that are powerful in their investment in that area. You know, so they care very, very much for the future of that area, because all of the family's wealth is tied into this one area, this one place, this one people group. So we are very invested in the future of this area and can therefore grant patronage to people who are of lower economic means to come in and rent their property and use their property. You know, I think we are getting to that place again in the cycle of property, the cycle of history, the cycle of currency, the cycle of demographics, where we are going to see, you know, I can see this happening with our kind of BlackRock idea of, you know, having a bank, if you want to call it that, but that would be the aristocratic family, or, you know, the institution in our case, buying up a big piece of property, and then having, you know, all of us young millennials and zoomers who are landless coming on and renting to own would be the difference for us. But having this great vast institutional fortune, this institutional land that is going to go multi-generational in one place, and then you have, you know, these people who cannot afford property coming in and working the land and being having a patron, having a benevolent patron who gives them access to land and housing and the ability to be fruitful. It's very interesting. Scotch Cuban, add to this a culture that steals children's minds, and many times the kids don't even want a profitable farm. It's very sad. They haven't been memed like we have been. Scotch Cuban, my raw milk farmer is facing this. Yeah, it's very... it's very sad, you know. We are taught to, and, you know, all, I don't know what the latest kind of
series are that aggrandize city living and professions. Yeah, so you know, we get this place where the youth are memed to want the city life. I was that way, you know. Oh, the hustle and bustle of the city and the energy of the city and the grand vision of go make your fortune in the city, become a hotshot at 21 years old, become a hotshot startup, become a hotshot ministry guy, become a hotshot media guy, you know, become a hotshot politician all at the age of 21, or you have failed. Whereas, you know, I wish, you know, Wendell Berry had been the kind of worldview that I was raised in of the love for heritage, you know, the love for your family being in one place. And, you know, the positive vision is that you will grow up in your father's business. The positive vision is that you will build your economy and become a local legend rather than some urban corporate hotshot. And that local legend status happens over generations. You know, it doesn't happen at the age of 21. It's very sad. That the you know, and it's incredibly encouraging that the meme, you know, this is where we come in. We are becoming very effective at putting Wendell Berry-esque worldview into meme form that young men can adopt. And you know, homesteading it's become fashionable. It's becoming, you know, it literally is beating out $1 billion productions by Hollywood. You know, a lot of dudes are just watching YouTube videos of dudes with their farm and dudes with their family and being like, yeah, this is pretty cool. You know, it's like, this is great. It's great. Yeah, Kodiak Joe, this is why we need to separate from that culture and only interact with like-minded men. James, algebra was developed by Arabs as a means of dividing inheritance. Fascinating. I don't know what that squiggly Arabic text means. Please translate. Inshallah. Shukran. David Burchard, welcome, fine sir. A good evening to you. Rent to own from a friendly institution is a game changer, and by God will we change the game. John Noel, welcome, fine patriarch. It's why the generations matter, because you can train your young men with these values. Yeah, praise God. Praise God. So it's very interesting, you know, this chapter, you know, kind of weighing the democratic kind of principles of the Puritans, the Pilgrims, who who had a desire to start a new world, you know, because they didn't like the culture of England. And then you had the aristocratic South, which was a bunch of wealthy landowners who were wanting space for their aristocratic dreams and visions. And it's interesting how he said, like, a lot of the laws and mores of America came from these people, but the great men that started off the revolution and carried the revolution came from these men. You know, so isn't that a very interesting dynamic? You know, how culturally very democratic, but when it came to actually creating and doing anything, it was the aristocratic values. It's very very fascinating, because I think that's where we find ourselves now, you know, is contemplating very much like the Puritans and the Pilgrims. We want separation from that culture, from the dominant culture. We want separation from what we consider to be toxic and hostile culture. So we want to find frontier. We want to find space, you know. We want to find wildland where we can go and be amongst our own people, our own mores, our own laws, our own culture, and create a new world. Now, the realities of that space is that it's often going to be by leaving behind, by sacrificing the comfort and wealth of the old world. So in a sense, there's a very democratic, in a sense, a very egalitarian nature about such an endeavor. You know, you go start some community somewhere, there's a lot of helping each other out. There's a lot of communal generosity. There's a lot of people starting from scratch. There's a lot of disaffected people seeing hope and arriving with nothing. At the same time, in order to get this
in order for this to ever go anywhere, you need some aristocratic men. You need men who are of wealth, who are of power, of influence, of great will to actually do things, to wield their aristocraticness. You know, it's a very fascinating dynamic that we find ourselves in, this populism plus aristocracy. And I think it all comes down to, you know, I think in our liberal upbringing, we've been taught like democracy is a worldview. Democracy is a operating system, and aristocracy is a worldview and an operating system, an evil one, let me tell you. Whereas when you come to think of it, you know, populism and aristocracy are simply contexts of an area, of a people, of a place. Both can serve their people and can serve their place. And we are seeing that both can exist almost side by side as long as they serve their people in place. You know, so people who are disaffected and of low income and of low ability and of low, you know, people who are not aristocratic, of course they want, you know, they want people to help them out. You know, we're all of us hoping, you know, for what we cannot achieve in our own strength, right? You know, if you can't afford land or a huge family or peace and prosperity away from violent and impoverished people or places, we are all of us hoping for a hand up. We are all of us hoping for friends and brothers who would help us into the new world, into the promised land. At the same time, if some great man arrives and he wishes to serve the people and the place that he is rooted to, that is at the same time a great joy and a great relief for many of the people who are more democratic and populist, you know. And I think that's what we saw. A very great example of this is the Donald. You know, we saw this aristocratic in the sense that he had family wealth, generational family wealth, and yet appealed very broadly, very to the populist interest. You know, it definitely is by no means a mutually exclusive position to have both populism and aristocracy coexisting, because the people in the place. And I think that's very quickly is what is going to transpire in any new community, in any new tribe, is an incredible generosity, an incredible equality. You know, as much as all of this makes our like anti-communist cringe, but there's going to be an incredible communal feeling in any new tribe, in any new people group who are settling a new frontier, to look out for one another, to be very generous to one another. And it's important to put in-group bounds on that. You know, the socialist communist manifesto is like, well, we're going to use this to destroy the middle class by opening it to everyone. And it's like, no, just for our people. It's an incredibly healthy thing. And within that community, an aristocracy is going to arise. Men, by their ability, by their strength, by their courage, by their mastery, are going to rise in honor among those people, and a natural aristocracy will arise. Now, what de Tocqueville is saying is, how does that aristocracy convey, lay up an inheritance to its children's children? Because an aristocracy only carries on as an aristocracy if the next generation inherits that power and influence and wealth. So it's all very interesting to think on. Drongo, algebra. I assume it says algebra. Thank you. Very, very handy translation there. Who knew that James was just so proficient in many languages, such as Arabic? I always enjoy Arabic speakers when they speak English, their accent. And I enjoy the sound of Arabic being spoken. It's very therapeutic, believe it or not. I wouldn't mind, were I proficient at learning languages, I probably would enjoy learning Arabic. Scotch Cuban, helping a friend from church build his house this weekend. He basically won't have a mortgage, building it while living with in-laws. Praise God, man. What a great context. What a great setup. Yeah, praise God. I Spoke on the phone today with a mutual, with an Anon, whose father, you know, got each of the boys set up, you know, helped them with property, helped them with business set up. And just, you know, hearing their testimony of how the family looks out for each other and you know, lays up an inheritance. It's like, man, it's so wholesome. You know, praise God, it's so wholesome. And it's like, what a great and positive vision, you know. Kharabik. Thank you, Ranga. That's a very good phonetic. Kharabik. RJJ, I like to call it nationally social. Well, sir, that's very novel. We shall have to do a book study on it. I think the other very interesting thing that he speaks about was the middling of America, which was different, you know, in that almost every man is educated and capable, which is not the case in Europe, where there was vast inequalities and economic impoverishment, which prevented men from having a general education. You know, this is again a great inheritance of the Pilgrims and the Puritans, is a Bible education. You know, the Pilgrims were very diligent in teaching children to read the Bible and understand the Bible. This literacy, you know, and then applied to, you know, go out and have a trade and work diligently, you know, the whole Protestant work ethic, a moral code that every man understands and has memorized. And, you know, it's what an amazing lifting of a society. And so, you know, that rising tide, you know, so while there were no superstar galaxy brain aristocratic socialites like there was in France and Europe, there also wasn't the dregs of society. And so we find ourselves there again, you know, with our poor, you know, because again, what is the nationalist answer to the social problem of the underclass, you know, the poor underclass of your culture, of your nation, whatever your nation is. And, you know, that the half of that answer is the education in biblical literacy. Biblical literacy, you know, understanding that we are made by God. There is inherent value. We're not just trash floating in opioid and trailerville. That we have inherent value regardless of our context. You know, you can grow up in poverty. You can grow up dirty and around poverty and violence. But if you are taught the inherent value that God will make a covenant with you and your family, that God will bless you, that God will direct your steps, and now you go and give your gift. Now you go, you work your gift, and God will make something of your life. You know, what an amazing worldview to give children. Instead, now with liberal nihilism, children are taught grievance. You know, so, oh, you're in poverty and violence? Well, that's white men's fault. Now, you know, they're just being taught grievance and victimhood. They're being taught victimhood, you know. So it's very interesting. Based guitarist, welcome, fine sir. Greetings to you. So yeah, it's all very interesting. Old de Tocqueville, I praise God. Enjoy. We are back. We're so back. Nothing going to keep me down. Tomorrow, 4 p.m. And we shall continue where we have left off. I God bless you, gentlemen. I God bless you. That did not work out. I bless you, gentlemen, and may God bless you. Praise God. Love you, boys. We'll see you all tomorrow.